The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia L. Khoury, and today I'm really, really thrilled to be joined by Rebecca Duggan, who is Local Campaigns Officer for the East of England for the NSPCC. And I think every parent in the country, the heart's going to swell a bit hearing that you're on the show because you do such tremendous work, and we're dying to hear all about it. So, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us on The Parents Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really pleased to be here.
So, Rebecca, it's brilliant to have you on the show. And I wanted to ask you, can you tell us a little bit about the work that the NSPCC does, just in case any parents out there have been living in a cave and haven't heard about the NSPCC, because I don't think there's many of them out there.
No, definitely. I'm always very proud to speak about who I work for. So the NSPCC stands for the National Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Children. And we are a leading UK children's charity who have been looking out for children for over 140 years. And we offer lots of different services. I work for the campaigns team, and we also look after Childline, which is a service that is run by the NSPCC, and it's for children. It's a free, private and confidential service where they can talk about anything they want, and they're here for children online, on the phone, at any time.
That's brilliant. I know. I think every child in the country knows about Childline. Your outreach is just so fantastic. So now, today we wanted to talk to you specifically about healthy relationships. Can you help us kind of paint a picture of what a healthy relationship looks like, please, Rebecca?
Definitely. You know, really happy to be speaking on this. So a healthy relationship is going to be one where your child or teenager feels safe. They respect the other person and they feel respected themselves. We're going to see that there's honesty amongst that relationship, whether that's a boyfriend, a girlfriend, or it might be a friendship relationship. We don't want to see dishonesty. We want to see maintaining good communication with the other person. We want to see young people staying calm during arguments. And one of the most important things as well is I think there has to be an even power balance. So for an example, that they are of similar age or ability, what we can see is that sometimes the age disparity can pose a power balance issue because one person may be maturer, they may be more knowledgeable, and the other person may not be as well. So it can pose some issues. And they share an understanding of what consent is with that other person as well. So there's just some few ideas of what a healthy relationship would look like. Yeah.
Brilliant. I think coming from the NSPCC, parents are going to find your advice really, really valuable. They're lovely, simple ideas and actually really, really easy to remember and to when you're talking to your child. So that's trust, respect, good communication, even power balance and age, of course, because that can always be a source of concern. But that's really helpful, Rebecca. So as parents or carers who are listening in, I mean, I think we all need to be on the lookout for signs of an unhealthy relationship. Are there characteristics or traits or patterns that you see in unhealthy relationships that we can be looking out for?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, realizing that your child or a child, you know, might be involved in an unhealthy relationship can be quite upsetting and worrying for parents and carers. And it can be quite difficult to deal with. But some signs would include spending little time with family or friends. So they might be otherwise distracted or having to spend time with the person they're in a relationship, which takes that time away from them doing things with their family or friends. They could be being told what to wear. So you might notice your child not wearing particular clothes or starting to wear other garments of clothes that maybe cover their body up or so on. And this list isn't extensive as well. There's many more, but always needing to let the person know where they are and what they're doing. That can be quite controlling, and that's not healthy in itself. They might have their social media accounts monitored, or sometimes an unhealthy relationship would require that person not to have social media at all. They might feel like they have to do things that they're uncomfortable with, and this could include being pressured into sexual behaviour, sending nudes or sexual images. It could mean that they're asked to do something illegal for somebody. They could have their money, access to food or day-to-day items controlled. They may feel reluctant to go to school or college, or maybe they have an extracurriculum activity that they go to. So there might be issues of why they don't want to go there. They might be prevented from working or going to school or college. And there could be persistent changes to the child's mood and behaviour. And these can be signs that something is wrong. And those moods as well will depend on how that person in the relationship is treating them as well. So if they're giving them lots of compliments and treating them well, that could increase a happy mood. But then the opposite, where they're being told what to wear, being prevented from doing certain things, you could see changes in their mood where they become quite anxious or low in mood. And you might also see being bullied or experiencing sexual bullying, either online, in private, or in the front of others at home or in school as well.
You've broken that down so nicely, Rebecca, and it makes it really practical and accessible. I can see the kind of main theme in what you're saying is control, right? If you see that somebody is trying to control any element of your child's behavior, then time to look a little bit more in detail into that friendship.
Definitely. And I think it's really important to kind of highlight right now as well that often when we think about relationships, we are going to think about that relationship where it's two people coming together to get to know and love each other. But we're also talking about relationships and friendships as well. So just to bear that in mind, that healthy relationships stems across lots of different relationships, not just the boyfriend or the girlfriend or the girlfriend and the girlfriend and so on. But also just wanted to add as well that we have trained helpline counsellors that can offer support and advice over the phone. And children and young people up to the age of 19 can also contact Childline via our one-to-one chat or get support themselves through our telephone line.
That's brilliant. So, I mean, for example, if you were noticing something, like, for example, your daughter or son isn't wearing jeans anymore because their buddy said, oh, no, jeans aren't cool. And you see that in more than one instance. Of course, I mean, just one thing wouldn't probably be enough to raise a red flag. But if you see a pattern of controlling behavior, then time to either get advice or go straight and talk to your son or daughter.
Definitely. You know, there could be lots of different signs. One thing alone might not identify that. And looking for those patterns that are happening, those ongoing behaviours that have maybe changed. However, what I would say is, even if you've noticed one thing, having that open and honest conversation with your child can only bring positivity. It can only benefit them, because there could be other things that are going on in that child or young person's life of why they aren't wearing particular clothes or why they want to wear it. So always having those conversations, as soon as you start noticing that your child has started to dress differently or behave differently, just have that open conversation as well. And it also builds that trust as well, because we want our children to go to a trusted adult to speak to, whether that's their parent, the carer, or a professional in their school or an extra curriculum activity. We would rather that than them go to somebody who we don't know is trustworthy, or to go online and get that information. So have those open conversations with children.
Brilliant. Thank you. And could you help us figure out the best way to approach these kind of relationships or how to speak about these kind of relationships or these kind of issues with children? Because obviously you want to have a constructive conversation. You want to scaffold it, make sure it goes well, because I think lots of us parents out there are thinking, oh no, tricky conversation, don't want to do this, it's going to spark a big row. So how do we do it constructively? I'd love your advice.
Okay, so I know as a parent myself that it can seem a little bit awkward to maybe start having these conversations, and that's completely understandable, especially if nobody had those conversations with parents themselves as children as well. And we want to break that cycle. We want to make these conversations as normal as possible, because they are things that happen in life. So what I would say is there's a few ways that you could make it easier. I always start though with saying be curious and not furious, okay? Sometimes our children might come to us and say, I've been speaking to somebody, or I've met this boy or this girl, or are they them? And we might panic as a parent. So find a good time to start that conversation. So your child, we want them to feel relaxed and confident that they're not going to be interrupted. So when your child, either they come to you or you'll go to your child, give them that space where you fully actively listen to them without jumping in. And also it's quite easy for us to make suspicions and conclusions before they've even finished speaking. And you could try going on a walk together, so you're in a nice, calm outdoor space away from the home in the car, so it might feel less pressure. I've had those conversations with my two grown, they're 16 and 19 now, and we've had many conversations in the car, which is a very relaxed, less pressured environment. The only people at home, so ensuring that maybe if they've got siblings, they might not want their older siblings to hear that conversation. So ensuring that, you know, it's a safe, quiet space where they can open up as well. Make the conversation relevant. So that could be by using their experience or learning about sex and relationships in school and talking about couples in the media. Or maybe they've been watching a TV series or a film together and one of the characters is in a relationship. So thinking about kind of open-ended questions like, what do your friends think of that? Or what do you think of that relationship? What do you think, if that's a healthy relationship or not? And getting their views on it. Because the things that they see on TV and in the media, they do play an influence on them. And they're usually very interested in these things. So looking at something that's relevant and that they enjoy and relating it to the conversation can really help with that as well. Don't rush. So always let children take their time. It can help to have a few kind of short conversations rather than trying to cover everything at once. And I would say little and often really is an effective way to relay that information or to have those sensitive conversations with children, and let them know that you are there for them, that we are there for them whenever they're ready to talk. Because sometimes children or young people might shy away from those questions, or it might make them feel a little bit cringe, like, I can't believe my parent or Karen wants to speak about this with me. And what I found is that sometimes it might go away and then actually come back an hour later and say, actually, can we speak about this? So just be patient with them. And yeah, that would be some of my guidance.
So many gems in there. I just got to come back to it, because I curious, not furious. That's brilliant. That's got to be my mantra. It's like you've been listening into my family conversations. Honestly, I've got to take that to heart, Rebecca. That was brilliant. And I love the going for a walk or drive, because I've kind of, when you say that, I've accidentally seen what you're talking about, particularly with my son. If we're in the car and I'm driving him to football or something like that, just because I think I'm not staring straight into his, you know, having a chat, it loosens the conversation for some reason, just because we're side by side rather than face to face with each other.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And the same, I've had many a conversations, you know, and awesome as well. When we're having these conversations with, you know, children, we want them to know that it's not about being right or wrong, and that we are all learning. And I would say as well that it doesn't really matter how old the child is. We want to treat them with maturity in these situations. So, you know, even taking them for, you know, a hot chocolate in a cafe, like you would with a friend, and have a conversation, and making that a little bit of a special time for you as well. So, yeah, you can do something nice as well with them around that.
Lovely. And the little and often, I think, is such a great idea, because I think quite often it's easy to build those conversations into something massive, and thinking you kind of procrastinate and put it off because you think it's going to take an hour and that'll be the rest of the evening. Whereas you're right, just little toe dips here and there.
Yeah.
Probably keep the normal flow of the conversation going, instead of, because the last thing kids want is a big, heavy conversation. So your suggestion, so much sense.
Definitely. I think sometimes those kind of sit down conversations can seem a bit formal, and that we're setting the rules and this is the way it is. And that's not our advice. Our advice is to make it a nice, relaxed environment and conversation. And, you know, we have, say, talk pants, which is for primary school age children, 3 to 11. And, you know, with that, we say little and often over a period of time. It's about developing that learning and understanding as they grow, because each year they progress, it will show different challenges, maybe different risks. You know, when they transition from primary to secondary school, there's going to be new conversations that we would have to have. So keep that going, because one conversation at the age of 9 or 10 or 11 isn't going to sort us for life. It's about ongoing all the way up until they're adults, and even beyond that sometimes. Yeah.
Great. That's brilliant. And it gets you into the habit, doesn't it? If you're doing it little and often, it just becomes less daunting. But so many gems in there. I think parents will find that incredibly, incredibly useful. And there's one topic that I know is a tricky one, because and it is consent, or discussions around the concept of consent. I have to say, like, being an older parent myself, it's not a conversation that was ever had with me in my life. You know, it is a more recent concept, but very, very, very important and very relevant. And we need to get it right as parents. And so I'd also love your advice about how to approach the topic of consent, because it's brilliant that schools cover it, and it's brilliant that the NSPCC go into schools and discuss about these issues, but we should be on board too as parents and carers, and we should be saying the same thing. So tell us what to do, basically.
Definitely. Yeah, it's definitely more effective when we've got at home or where the child is living involved with those conversations, and not just the school as well. And, you know, hearing that from different adults, it, you know, it shows a consistency as well. And for every parent, there's going to be different certain topics of discussion that can be tricky to start. And although they may be difficult, our website does have lots of hints as well and tips about starting these conversations. But if you're struggling to figure out where to start with this, what you can do is, what I suggested earlier, is make it relevant to them. So maybe you're watching something on TV where consent is part of the story, and you could use that story to kind of illustrate what was done right and what was done wrong. So making it relevant to them. Again, it's really important to keep having these conversations to help young people remember that it's their choice and saying no is okay, and that they should never feel pressured into doing these things as well. It's also really important as well that if you're they're telling you something upsetting, to remain calm as well. Never blame them for what's happened, and get them the right support as well. Concerning consent, it's really important that all children and young people should understand that no means no. So that's why we deliver talk pants to children at a young age, and then we have the healthy relationships in school as well. The onus is not on the young people to look after themselves at this stage of life, but it is important that they feel empowered, that they can say no, when they don't want to do something. And, you know, we often will think about consent in regards to sexual activities and relationships, but we don't always have to base it on that conversation. We can teach children that consent is when somebody says no, that's what they mean. So if they don't want to go out to play with you, they don't want to speak with you online, then we have to learn to respect other people. So sometimes we can start incorporating consent and no means no into everyday activities. And then when ready, we can incorporate that into sex and relationships as well. And, you know, as a parent myself, sometimes it can be very daunting to think, but children will explore, and we want them to know that they have the right to say no. And yeah, so that would be some tips around that.
That's fantastic, Rebecca. Really, really helpful. And I'm sure that'll be great for parents to hear as well and give them the confidence to address these topics, because ultimately it's got to come from us and parents and carers as well to reinforce what school and what organizations like the NSPCC are saying. Before I let you go, any thoughts about the topics that we've been talking about, anything you'd like us to know about the work the NSPCC is doing that, and indeed you mentioned your website, it'd be great to share that with parents too.
Definitely. So just a couple of things. We do offer lots of support and advice here at the NSPCC and at Childline as well. So we have our trained counsellors on Helpline that can offer support, and that's 0808 800 5000. And for Childline, it's 0800 1111. But we all have a responsibility as adults, whether we're parents or carers, or we are just an adult in the community, for the welfare and the well-being of children and young people in society. And that's why we have launched Listen Up, Speak Up, which is a campaign, and we're offering free one-hour workshops to any adult all over the UK. And that's encouraging adults to take our free training sessions or workshops, and it will help them learn the signs of abuse and neglect and how to report them and what they can do to support a young person. So if anyone is listening and interested about learning about more of this, please just search for NSPCC Listen Up, Speak Up on your web browsers. Many people worry about being wrong, but ask yourself this instead: what if I'm right? And by doing something now, you could be preventing something terrible happening in the future later. And for all parents and carers that are listening as well, just know that you are doing the right thing by having these conversations with your children. Because if we don't have them with our own children or the children we work with, they may turn to people who are not trusted or might provide that misinformation. And the internet is a big, wild place out there with a lot of great information, but a lot of not factual information that could put children in extremely vulnerable situations. So be confident and know that you're doing the right thing by having these conversations with children. Yeah.
Brilliant. And indeed, as you say, Rebecca, I mean, what's the worst that's going to happen? The conversation might be a bit awkward, but you'll have opened the door, you'll have started the dialogue, and it's a very innocuous outcome compared to what could happen if you don't have those conversations. So the chats are always relevant and important.
100%. And, you know, I wish that people had had those conversations with me as a young person. And unfortunately, I had to learn that as an adult. You know, many of us learn as adults. So just because we didn't have those conversations, we need to break that cycle. And we then need to start having them as well. So yeah, it's really been great. It has. And I hope any listeners find, you know, our advice useful.
I'm absolutely sure they will, Rebecca. It's been great. I've scribbled loads of notes. I've got loads of gems of advice from your wise words. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to be here talking about this and representing the NSPCC as well. Thank you.
Thanks a million for joining us on the Parents Show.
Thank you. Take care now.
We'll take a quick break now on the Parents Show on Mix 92.6.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Thanks for joining us again on The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia El-Khoury, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Emma Smith from Raiden Solicitors here in St. Albans. And they are, of course, sponsors of The Parents Show, we are delighted to say. And she's a solicitor there. Emma, thank you so much for joining us on The Parents Show today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we're going to talk to you a little bit about law as a career. So we're going to pick your brains, Emma, over the next 15, 20 minutes and just find out all about it, if that's all right. So first of all, tell us about your journey into law and what drew you to it.
So my journey into law was much more unconventional to the traditional route. I actually got a bachelor's degree in history before I did even entered the legal world. This was just because when I was doing my A-levels, it didn't even cross my mind to study law. I'd seen lawyers in media and everything else, and they just seemed so intelligent and everything else.
I can relate.
I was just like, that doesn't seem like it'd be for me. So it was only after I finished my degree and I went into the working world, I got a job through a connection at a pub I was working at as a legal secretary in a local law firm. And I loved it. Absolutely loved it. Worked in civil litigation team. And I thought I really want more hands-on involvement in the cases. And the way to do that was to become a solicitor myself. So I applied and got onto the graduate diploma in law. And I studied that for 2 years part-time whilst full-time working as a legal secretary. And then halfway through that course is when I actually joined Raiden Solicitors as a paralegal. So I actually took a step up in my career whilst I was studying, which is a real benefit of law, that you can do that. You can sort of progress yourself as you're studying at the same time. I then did the legal practice course part-time whilst full-time working. And during that time, I also progressed to the training contract, which is when you're a trainee solicitor. So there was still that career progression happening at the same time as my studying. So it really does mean that it's accessible to people who've already got a degree. It's an option if you've got a career change. And I just found that law really made me tick. If you like a challenge and like work to not always be the same every single day, it's fantastic. It takes dedication, but it's worth it for how rewarding it is as a career. That would be my key thing that has kept me interested in it.
But that what a fantastic way to get into it. I wouldn't have thought that that was a possibility. So in total, how many years has it taken you to get where you are now?
So I started my bachelor's degree when I was 18. So from my bachelor's degree in history, starting that, I would say it's about 7 years to qualification, because I qualified in 2023. I don't know if my maths are quite right, but from that, that's quick maths. Yeah, so 2018 to 2023 was when I qualified, September 2023. So it's a pretty clean, straight amount of years.
And the great thing about it is you got to explore the route that you intuitively thought you were going to go around, but then it didn't rule out law and you could come back to it. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, so I got to do a degree in an area that really interests me. Like, I love history. I would never change the path I had, because doing a history degree was great. I loved it. And I would say, if there's anyone in their A-levels that even is considering law but isn't certain, there's no harm in considering doing something that you really enjoy now and then revisiting law in the future. It just makes the journey a little bit longer. So if you're absolutely certain that you want to do law, just go for it.
Yeah. But if you're not, like you say, and it's funny, because you think you're a type to be a lawyer or not, like you said, but to find out it really is the passion, it's the thing you were looking for, is fantastic.
Yeah, definitely. And I think when I got into family law, it just clicked even more. Because I'd enjoyed civil litigation and what I saw of that as legal secretary, but the work as a family lawyer is much more personal. It's much more emotion. And I think if you're quite an empathetic person, and what makes you tick is helping people through a hard time and seeing them out the other side, family law is great for that, because that is literally what you are doing. You're taking on clients in a tough time in their life, and you're helping them get through a process and advise them during a process. And then you get them to the other side and they come out the other side better off. You know, like that's what you're aiming to achieve. And that's really, really rewarding if that's something that interests you. And yeah, that's my, it's what brought me into family law and has kept me interested as well.
Fantastic. And I think you've juxtaposed two lovely ideas that are not conventionally put together, which is empathy and law. And I think that's not conventionally what people put together with law, but it's beautiful that there's a humanity. You're bringing out the human side and the value in where the law comes in as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely where family law sort of shines for people. If you're that kind of person, you've gone into law, it's like it's something clicks. And yeah. I think every family lawyer I've met is extremely passionate about family law because they've been in law and then they've gone into family law and it's just been a passion for them to do that work. Wow. Yeah.
And so it sounds like professionally it's really fulfilling your expectations, maybe even exceeding them.
Yeah, definitely. It's intellectually challenging, which is what I want because I like being challenged. Every day I'm challenged with new cases that is different from the last case I had on my case list. And so it just keeps me learning and developing constantly, which when you're that kind of personality that thrives off that, it's perfect. And the rewarding part is when you get to witness the relief and sort of the optimism of your clients by the time you get to the other end of their case and they can see the future and they can see it will be okay. And you sort of let them go off into the sunset. It's great.
Lovely. And do you think it's been a difficult route to choose? Was it a slog at times?
Yeah, I would say it wasn't difficult to choose to go into law because I think if once you get there, you're there like, yes, I definitely want to do this. But the actual studying and the working is a challenge. It's a balance, especially if you're doing it the way I did it, part-time study with full-time working. It is balancing your own well-being with studying, with a very intense job, really. Law is intense. There's no really way around it. It's why a lot of lawyers are very passionate about their work, because you have to have that passion to get through the study and everything else. And it's something you really would have to want to do. And it does take grit and determination, and support of family is also very important. But yes, I would say don't be put off by the amount of work that it is to get into law. If it's something that you really want to do, just get through it because it's worth it. It's a lot of work, but it's worth it.
It is a lot of work, but it's worth it. That's what I think. I just have this mental image of these huge books that you've got to learn off by heart to get there. But it's worth it.
It is worth it. And there's some great courses out there for training and everything else. And I think definitely it's worth it.
Brilliant. And if listeners, I could imagine, you know, everybody, all parents, I mean, or the vast majority of parents would love their children to become lawyers. Is a law degree the way to go? Is that the route?
So if you're in your A levels and you're certain you want to do law, go down that route. I think if that's your what you really want to do. But if you're not sure, there's always options of doing work experience if you're in your A-levels. We actually have a work experience scheme at Raiden Solicitors, and applications open in January 2026 for summer 2026 work experience, and you can apply for that through us. And that could be a way of testing if law is where you would like to go, if you're a bit unsure of what you want to do for your degree. So it's more straightforward to go straight into the traditional law degree. But otherwise, if you're not sure, go and find some experience, go and test yourself if you want to do it. And then you'll know, is probably my advice with that. And if you're still not sure, do something you love at university, and then you can always go back and change your mind. You've got a lot of time in your 20s to retrain.
Brilliant. Sound advice, Emma. And so is anyone in your family a lawyer? Do you think it helps if you're thinking about law to know somebody who's a lawyer, to have a family background in law?
So I would say network is very important in law. it's well worth having contact. So if that contact comes from your family, that's a massive benefit. But I personally did not have any family members that were lawyers. No one knew how the process worked. It was a lot of research and sitting at the table and working out how to get into law. And I just so happened to have a contact through my fiance's family in law. So it was, and meeting a lady at the pub as well that I got on well with. It's speak to people, let them know that you're interested in law. There's lots of events as well that I know a lot of law firms do at the universities, and I know we have done careers fairs at Harts University, and we do them at schools in the local area. So go along to those and chat about your passion for law and how you get into it, and I'm sure they'll have lots of advice of networking ideas. And speaking to us at careers fairs itself is a networking activity, so just get involved with the law community. It's a big community and we're always welcoming.
Brilliant. It sounds like network helps, but if not, you can build your own network. And it sounds like serendipity and a bit of luck has a role to play too.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It's put yourself out there.
Yeah.
If it's meant to be, it'll be.
Great stuff. Okie doke. And have you any tips for listeners who would like their children to enter law, or indeed themselves want to enter into law, maybe ready for a mid-career change?
So I would say applying for various work experience schemes. And if you can't get onto a work experience scheme, there's always the option of volunteering. Just get your foot in the door, because that's what really helped me. I got my foot in the door by helping a local law firm out first. I didn't get the legal secretary job straight away. That was given to me because I got my foot into the door at the law firm by doing that archiving work, which wasn't a full-time job or anything else, but it got me in the door and it built that network for me. And that is really important. To just don't expect to just walk into a training contract or whatever without doing the groundwork of getting your foot in the door, meeting people and everything else. And the earlier you start that, the better, is my advice, because it just puts you in really good stead to have that experience under your belt.
Brilliant. And it sounds like it's totally possible for adults too. I mean, if you're based, or your kind of basic degree isn't in law, there's every opportunity to start a new career. It feels like it's a thriving industry, and that there just aren't enough lawyers out there. So probably a good choice.
Yes, yeah. So I was 22 when I considered law for the first time. So it's definitely not shut to people if you're over the age of 18. Yeah, it's a great industry, and it's becoming easier to qualify as well, because they've just recently changed the way that you qualify. So they've got the solicitor's qualifying examination now, which I didn't do personally because I wasn't qualifying at the time that it came in. But I do know that others have now done it that are younger than me. And we've got a trainee at the moment who's doing it. And we interviewed her this morning myself. So there will be a podcast coming out on our Spotify interviewing her. So if you want to know more information about the solicitor's qualifying examination, you can log in to our Spotify and listen to that.
And that's Raiden Solicitor's Spotify account.
Yeah, that's our Spotify account. Yes. There's other routes as well, such as Silex qualification. So I don't know a lot about this, but we do have Katie Skinner at our firm, who's a senior associate, and she qualified using this route. And we've also done an interview with her on our Raiden Solicitor's podcast as well on Spotify. So that would be really informative if you want to know more about that. It's more practical, is my understanding. You're much more in the working world, and then you do exams on the side. So yeah, it's lots of routes that you can take.
Absolutely. And tell us the name of that route as well. Did you say Silex?
Silex is the short form, but it's spelled C-I-L-E-X. So if you just Google that, you'll get all the information on it.
Fantastic. Or on Raiden Solicitor's Spotify.
Or on our podcast.
It sounds like there's a wealth of information there too.
Yeah. Yeah. We've done a few. So it's Legal. Legal Paths is the podcast. So yeah, it'll have a lot of information on there if there's any extra questions you've got.
Brilliant. So Emma, it sounds like you've found your calling in applying the law, and it's applying law and becoming a solicitor. It's so refreshing and lovely to hear that it plays such an important role in your life.
Yes, yeah. I feel very lucky to have found something that suits me so well. And I can only hope that people listening find similar success. Yeah, it's been lovely.
Brilliant. Oh, lovely to talk to you today, Emma, and thanks for joining us on The Parents Show.
Thanks very much. It's lovely to be here.
Emma Smith from Raiden Solicitors here in St. Albans, sponsors of The Parents Show.
Well, not so much going wild in the country as going wild in Hertfordshire. The Hertfordshire Natural History Society is celebrating its 150th anniversary with a special exhibition at St. Albans Museum and Gallery. Nick Hazel from Mixed Mornings spoke to David Utting, the secretary of the society, and asked him if he was looking forward to the exhibition.
So we're very excited about it because it's a great opportunity. You don't get to be 150 very often, so we're very pleased that the museum have given us this chance to celebrate all that we've done over the years and look forward, because obviously this is a challenging time for wildlife that we live in at the moment.
It is. 150 years since the society was founded, am I right?
That's correct, yes. It actually started in Watford as Watford Natural History Society and Hertfordshire Field Club, but 4 years later they changed the name to the Hertfordshire Natural History Society, and that's what we've remained ever since.
Yes, and still going strong. So tell us a bit about what the society does before we talk about the exhibition.
I mean, our terms of reference say that we're encouraging a wider interest in natural history, conservation of wildlife habitats, geological features, environmental protection, all those sort of good things. But if you boil it down to our sort of special role or niche, and that's to look for local wildlife in Hertfordshire, to identify it, and then this is the important bit, to record it. And once, you know, we're sure that the records are correct, to publish the results. And what that does is to allow us to track population changes, changes in habitats, all sorts of other important changes in the living world, and know what's going on out there. And that's really useful, not just for natural historians, people interested in wildlife, but also for government, local government, people taking planning decisions, all sorts of things like that.
Okay, so now you've got this exhibition at the St. Albans Museum and Gallery. Tell us a bit about what we can see there.
Yes, we've got a wide range. I'm inclined to say something for everything, because for everyone, because there are going to be things for children and families as well. But what we've tried to do in particular is to feature, as it were, the iconic habitats of Hertfordshire and the iconic species. So you'll see a model of a chalk stream, which Hertfordshire is remarkable in the sense that it has about 10% of the world's chalk rivers. And the River Ver is one of them. And indeed, our model is actually going to be a model of the River Ver. Surrounding it will be all the special species that live in these chalk streams. So that's one of the things we're pleased about. Other habitats that we'll be looking at will be the ancient woodlands of Hertfordshire. And indeed, our new forest, which is just outside Sandridge, Hartwood as well, will be in there as well.
Great. So we've got quite a few things to see. And I gather we, provided they turn up on time, we'll see the peregrine falcons as well.
That would be nice, yes. I mean, we're very, very thrilled about the possibility that we'll be able to show the live stream of the peregrines laying eggs and then producing young, but it does rather depend on them making sure that they're there to do it. And at the moment, it's just slightly anxious, but I'm sure that they will, because they have done for the last 3 years. They've reared, I think, 7 chicks successfully in that time, and they're a wonderful feature of wildlife, you know, in the immediate vicinity of the museum. So we'll be encouraging people to go down to the cathedral as well to take a look, as well as just watching them on the screen.
Now, we're also going to find out a bit about how wildlife in the area is changing, isn't it? Because some species are becoming more and more rare, some are extinct, and other species are moving in, aren't they? Tell us a bit about that.
That's absolutely right. I mean, this is, as it were, one of the serious purposes of the exhibition is to make people more aware of what's going on. And some families in the living world are more susceptible to change more quickly. So birds particularly change more quickly than others. So we have lost species of birds, or we're probably in the process of losing them, that were once quite common in Hertfordshire. An absolutely prime example is the tree sparrow, which we had one of the last colonies of tree sparrows in the south of England, which was at Titton Hanger, the gravel pits there. And sadly, we lost it 2 or 3 years ago. It just ceased to be sustainable. The reasons for that are going to be a lot of different reasons as to why that happened. But the tree sparrows aren't there anymore. There's a butterfly that used to be very common right across Hertfordshire called the war butterfly. Just no longer exists here anymore. Other things that you might think are out there, nobody's seen an adder in Hertfordshire. Or nobody has seen a verifiable adder, I should say, in Hertfordshire in the last 10 years. And the dormouse, the hazel dormouse, is another species that we don't actually have any confirmed records of. So there are things like that. Actually, can I just also mention there's a kind of plant called Carex cespitosa. It's a Latin name. It's actually, I think it's called scarce tufted sedge. Hertfordshire is the only place in Britain where you will find this. It's not particularly threatened, but it's unique to Hertfordshire. So that will be in the exhibition too.
Excellent. We've got a few things that are not necessarily all welcome, but a few things that are moving into the area as well.
Well, this is the, welcome and unwelcome. I'm sure most people listening will have seen a red kite flying over their home or whatever, because they've become very common. But they were introduced at the very end of the 1980s into the Chilterns, and kites were at that point an incredibly rare bird of prey in Britain. And now, of course, most people see them every day, I should think. I certainly do. And that's a good introduction, if you like. We have ones that some people are not sure about, like the ringneck parakeets that seem to be spreading everywhere, but they weren't common 20, 30 years ago. And then we have the things that were introduced that we'd rather hadn't been. And a good example of that is the signal crayfish, which is an American species. I think it was brought in by fisheries for commercial reasons, but it's got into our streams.
Right.
And it's playing a role in driving out the native white-clawed crayfish. So that's a negative invasive species example.
Catherine Newley from the St Albans Museums also joined David and Nick. But first, Nick asked David whether there were activities for younger people as part of the exhibition.
We've got various things for them to entertain them. There's a footprint trail, which they can follow and try and find the animals that made the footprints. There's going to be dressing up, and I hear exciting things that Catherine's colleagues have been doing in terms of making all sorts of outfits. We're going to have a hunt for little mice and wrens, and there'll also be an outdoor trail. So people will be able to take a leaflet and go outside the museum and start walking around the neighbourhood down into Verulamium Park and to the cathedral, of course, and find a few things for themselves.
Now, Catherine Newley's here from St Albans Museums as well. Hello, Catherine. There are some activity sessions that you need to book, aren't there? Tell us about those.
Yeah, so alongside the exhibition, we're running several different activities. We've got a seed bomb and bird feeding making session, and that's in the Easter holidays on the 14th and 15th of April. And that's for families to come along and learn more about, preparing seed bombs that you can create colour and enhance biodiversity in your gardens, make fat balls. I'm sure most people may remember doing that as a child as an activity, but you can make a fat ball to hang in your garden and encourage a variety of birds to come along and enjoy an energy-rich feast in your garden and get to watch them enjoying that. We're also doing a bug modelling session in the May half term, so making little bugs out of Fimo clay, inspired by the exhibition. And David is going to be doing a talk for us, actually, on the 14th of May. So if you're interested in coming along and hearing more about the 150 years of the society, he'll be talking all about it then.
I think that'll be fun. We're going to compare what our Victorian forebears were interested in the natural world and the things that they got up to with the things that we do nowadays.
David, what does the Natural History Society want to get out of this exhibition?
Well, I mean, immediately we want our visitors to get really excited about our county's wildlife in all its glory. But we also want them to be a bit concerned about its future as well. And the Hertfordshire County Council working with local authorities and bodies like the Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust are currently preparing a nature recovery strategy for the county. So we want people to think about the things they can do to safeguard our precious wildlife heritage. And we also want them to come away thinking that they might, well, maybe they watch wildlife already, but perhaps they'd like to take it a bit further, become a recorder, if you like, a citizen scientist, because that's not only valuable, but it's also quite easy to do. And it's also very enjoyable. And I think that's an important message for us as well.
Brilliant. And the exhibition itself is free and you don't need to book, but you do need to book the activity sessions and David's talk, don't you?
Yes, so you can find out all the details for the sessions that we're running on our website on the What's On pages. If you just go to www.stalbansmuseums.org.uk, you can find out all the details there.
David Utting, Secretary of the Hertfordshire Natural History Society, and Catherine Newley from St Albans Museum, talking to Nick Hazel. The exhibition runs at St Albans Museum and Gallery until July the 6th.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.